Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Jurassic Park Radio. Join host Todd Jurassic as he explores the great outdoors and the great unknown. Here we go.
Hey, welcome everybody. This is Todd Jurassic, your host of Jurassic Park Radio. Tonight we have a special guest, Bigfooter, co-host of Monster X Radio, a member of the famed Olympic Bigfoot Project, Scotsman Shane Corson. Shane, you there? Maybe I don't have you hooked on yet. Shane, are you there?
Hello, Todd.
Yeah, hey, so learning this stuff's fun. Welcome, Shane.
Oh, yeah, I hear you. Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, you know what? You're a radio expert compared to me, but I'm glad to have you on. Shane has been involved in Bigfoot probably since he was a kid and has hosted Monster X Radio and is a member of the Olympic Bigfoot Project. And I thought it'd be kind of cool to have him on a different show rather than have him on his own show. So, Shane, just kind of glad to have you on, but I wanted to I got so many questions, I doubt I have enough time, and just feel free to just go with it. So what got you interested in monsters?
You know, I grew up in Scotland, and my mother actually got me interested in cryptids in general. And, of course, in Scotland, we have the Loch Ness Monster. And so my first love growing up was the Loch Ness Monster. And paleontology was another fascination of mine, anything to do with fossils and dinosaurs. And so my interest in the monster or cryptid world came from that, and mainly from my mother. And so as I got older, my mom introduced me to, you know, stories of the Yeti, you know, in the Himalayas, and Bigfoot in the Americas, the Yeren in China, and so these different cryptids around the world. And I really took a fondness to Bigfoot, and spent many years reading every book I can get my hands on, and watching every little TV show in search of, you know, the usual gateway drug, I guess, to this phenomena. And so I was fortunate to move to get a chance to move to the States. My mom being American, my dad was Scottish, so we moved to the United States, moved to actually the San Diego area, and my interest only grew, and I was that much closer to the phenomena, the Bigfoot phenomena. And so once again, you know, I had a lot more access to libraries and books and stuff like that, and I could take trips. I could go, you know, around the San Bernardino Mountains, the San Gabriel Mountains. I can go out to the high deserts. I could go to the Sierras, Yosemite. And so as I got older, I would venture out, you know, with friends, sometimes solo trips, doing a lot of backpacking and hiking and camping and looking into the phenomena as a whole. And I spent many years doing that, kind of chasing stories and talking to people about their encounters. And, well, I didn't get a whole lot in Southern California, to be honest with you. There's spots in Southern California that, historically speaking, do have reports, you know, but they're far and few between, you know, and usually they're much older reports, though, I mean, they still get them to this day. They're just not as prevalent as they are, say, in Northern California, Washington, Oregon, in British Columbia areas, where they're much more prevalent. And so I started venturing further north. You know, Yosemite used to be one of my favorite places to go. And while I was there in Yosemite, I mean, backpacking, hiking, I'd always kept an open mind and open eye for things. And in all my years in California, really, other than anecdotal stories and people sharing their encounters, I never really found anything of interest. And it wasn't until 2008 that I moved to Oregon. And that really was not just a move that changed my life from many ways, but it really launched me into where I'm at today. And so, yeah, to answer your question, you know, Loch Ness Monster and some of these other other well-known cryptids and monsters got me interested in the subject. But for some reason, I took a real keen look at the Sasquatch or Bigfoot phenomena. And I thought, you know, man, there's something to this. You know, there really is something to this. And I want to kind of pursue it regardless of if I ever find anything. I thought it was just a fascinating thing, the chance of that this creature could be in North America.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I know that living in Oklahoma, I started Sasquatch kind of along the same ways. I just getting outside, and then there wasn't a lot to do, so I would supplement it with metal detecting, Bigfooting, and everything, and I kind of really got into the crypto stuff just because, man, you know, it's pretty exciting. It makes it exciting to know that, hey, something's watching you in the woods, and, you know, is there something out there that we're not seeing? It's just right on the edge of, you know, and of, you know, cities and stuff. But, you know, I totally get that. And I've had stacks of VHS tapes. Thank God they're not, they're all on, you can get them on an Amazon sticker. So now, but, you know, I have 50 pounds of VHS tapes everywhere, but I totally get that. So have you, so this is basically how you got started with it. Have you hunted anything else other than Bigfoot before, or just primarily Sasquatch because where you were located?
You know, like you said, in Britain, I really didn't. I was where I lived. I lived on a little island, and so there was a lot of fossils, especially along the British coast. They have a lot of shale, and so you could find fossils. And so I really got into the fossil hunting, and that kind of led me, along with my mother, into like the whole Nessie. Could it be this surviving plesiosaur or something like that? And so I didn't really, other than kind of looking into it, researching that subject via books and whatever else I got my hands on. I didn't really do any field investigations or anything like that. I didn't really have access to get to, Loch Ness and some of these other lochs, these lakes where these cryptids were. And so it wasn't until I came to the States that I got into the Bigfoot phenomena. And then really, I'm always fascinated with, you know, reports of other creatures, cryptids, other possible animals that science is yet to categorize or prove their existence. But I've mainly, other than reading some stuff, I've only really stuck to the Sasquatch phenomenon. And that's all I quite honestly care to do at this point, because Sasquatch is real to me. I know Sasquatch to be real. And what it is my question. And so I'm really about, whether it's personal or for the greater the public, or maybe even Sasquatch itself, I don't know, but really into studying this creature, whatever it is.
Okay, so that's primarily what got you started doing the Monster X with Gunnar. It's just years of doing this out in the woods and kind of, hey, I want to talk about it now, or maybe talk to see if anyone else out there wants to talk about it then?
Yeah. I mean, so Monster X Radio is strictly about the Bigfoot phenomenon, though I will say that we do have a guy by the name, you may be familiar with him, Scott Martis, that'll sometimes cover Lake Champ. He'll jump in and do his own segment on Lake Champ and, Lake Champlain, and Champ, which is another water cryptid. And we invite guests on. I usually don't partake in those parts of the show because my interest is Sasquatch, though we've had in the past a few people on about, flying, petrosaurs or pterodactyls and some other cryptids. But my passion really is with Sasquatch, and that's kind of where Gunnar lies. Gunnar Monson, my co-host, fantastic researcher, but he used to work for the BFRO. I mean, he was a BFRO guy for many years, and he eventually left and is now, along with myself, a part of the Olympic Project, Bigfoot Project up in the Olympics. And we also do a lot of stuff Mount Hood area and the Tillamook Coast out here on the West Coast, Oregon and Washington. And so the show, yeah, absolutely. The show really is, it's a lot of fun for starters, a lot of fun. I can't talk about the Bigfoot subject enough. And so I love getting other investigators, researchers, enthusiasts, those that have had encounters or sightings or have, got some really compelling audio. I love getting scientists on the show, and I love skeptics. So it's really a hodgepodge of everything Bigfoot related that you can imagine packed into a show. And so far it's been not just fun, but I've learned a ton from guests. I mean, I learned a ton of stuff from guests. I'm always surprised. Just when you think you've heard it all or you thought of it all, someone will come up with a new hypothesis, opinion, idea, or maybe add a piece of that puzzle. And so for me, it's kind of like I'm in the classroom and I get to partake. And so it's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. I know Gunner does. And we got a great following. And I don't see us stopping anytime soon. We're having a blast. And it's giving me a lot of data from around the country to look at. And I could take bits and pieces of that or it as a whole and compile that data and add it to my data and, maybe start to see patterns, maybe starting to figure some things out with this Sasquatch phenomenon. And so the show is just, it's an absolute, it's a hoot, man. It really is. I enjoy it. And our guests, those we've had on, they've been so awesome. And I'm really looking forward to some of the future shows down the road here that, we'll get, some more scientists involved on the show, like Dr. Jeff Meldrum and Dr. Todd Distel in New York. So it's a blessing and definitely something I want to continue. And I encourage you, because I love your podcast and I could see your passion for it. And it does. You have to have a passion to do blog, any sort of radio. You have to have a passion, and you have to kind of know what you're talking about, or at least research what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just kind of people get sick of hearing me talk about it in person. So I guess my wife and a friend of mine, Chester Moore, who's been doing Bigfoot stuff for years, just bugged me to do this. And I figured, I'm going to give it a try. And, the thing that's cool is, like you said, you learn. And you think you got to figure it out. Oh, I got this figured out. I can. You just learn a lot of stuff, and you learn different angles, and you're like, every once in a while, you got to sit back, well, maybe I should scratch that idea and try that. So, and every time you think that you've got to figure it out, are you the only person doing something? You find out there's five other guys that have been doing it for 20 years longer than you have. So, but it's, it's cool because I think it's a team effort with this in particular. It's not something one person's going to solve, but I think with, especially with technology today and combining, minds like yourself, Meldrum, and, the guys you got at Olympic Project are great. This is definitely a solvable mystery, as is everything. I think we're on the greatest, on the edge, and in the beginning phase of the greatest time of research and discovery ever, because animals are smart. You go out in the woods. I live in a city. At night, there's raccoons, there's foxes, there's coyotes, and you don't see anything in the day. They work the sewer systems, they work the streets, they hide in the bushes. Animals adapt. And for as much as I love to protect the woods and everything, I know there's a lot of animals that can simply adapt to, a pressure from humanity. And doesn't mean I want to destroy all the woods. I'm just saying that, these things can hide. And people were in the woods 100 years ago. Everyone was in the woods. Now, no one's in the woods, and you go anywhere like a park, and people stay on trail. I'm the guy that's off trail, wants to know 50, feet past the trail, what's on the other side of that rock, what's in that stream, right, what's in that tree, and that's what part of it, this excitement, and there's a lot of excitement and adrenaline here and with it, and you learn a lot of stuff too. But so this has led you, I guess the Monster X has got you, what got you involved with the Olympic Project then, is that correct?
No, actually, Monster X was I got involved in Monster X. What really propelled me into the Olympic Project was a sighting I had in 2011 in the Mount Hood National Forest with some friends. And, I moved up to Oregon in 2008, and I started doing a lot of solo stuff. What I thought was research, what I thought was investigation. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I was a good tracker. At least I consider myself a decent tracker and stuff. So I track, I'd hike, I do everything I thought was correct as far as research. And I found some interesting impressions, in 2009, 10, I had some interesting things happen, but nothing I could scream Bigfoot until 2011 when I had an encounter, and then it rocked my world, flipped me upside down, and I realized that this was much bigger than myself, and this was something I could not prove. I didn't really know what I was doing. I thought I did. And so I wanted to get more involved, and I wanted to find a lot of like-minded individuals. There's a lot of people I'd followed. Cliff Berrickman, I followed the Olympic Project. I followed, the BFRO and a lot of other solo individuals out there. Joel Bielhart. I had followed them. I'd read about them. And finally, I decided, wow, there's something to this, and I'm not going to be able to to even, I don't even know where to begin. I thought I did, but I didn't. And so I started looking out groups, and the Olympic Project stuck out to me. And they were a fairly newly formed research group, but full of experienced and Bigfooters, experienced hunters, trackers, biologists. So there was a lot of science involved. There was a lot of experience involved. I was living in Oregon at the time, down in the Portland area, not too far away from Cliff Berrickman. But I really sought to get involved with the Olympic Project, even though they're in Washington, and I really hadn't done much of anything in Washington. And so it led me to contact Derek, and after doing some trips out with the Olympic Project, Derek asked me to come aboard the Olympic Project, and I'm a core member of the Olympic Project, and we've been going good ever since, and making, I think, headway in this endeavor. And so that's kind of what got me involved with the Olympic Project. Though Monster X has always been there, it was after, shortly after I got involved with the Olympic Project that I decided to branch out a little bit and see if I could get witnesses on the show and talk to them. You know, I wanted to find a broader audience. You know, a lot of your researchers, and not so much today because of the internet, but they would hand out business cards, or they would put their business card in a restaurant. Have you seen a Bigfoot? You know, I know Cliff Berrickman did that for a while, especially in the Clackamas area in Oregon. And other researchers had done that. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, I was like, shoot, I don't have a website. Blog talk. Let me do a radio show. And I had Gunnar Monson kind of, you know, helping run the Monster X show, you know, it's been great ever since. And now I got the Monster X thing going. I'm heavily involved with the Olympic Project, and I got some other groups that I do work closely with. And that's what got me involved with the project, was an actual encounter in 2011.
Okay, can you want to talk about that encounter? I know that was kind of, there's some interesting history behind that, and then I looked into that a little bit, and it's pretty fascinating. Just let you tell about it.
Yeah, you know, I've talked about it before, but, you know, so in 2011, one of my other passions has been fishing. I've been fishing my whole life, and some of my coworkers wanted to go on a fishing trip, and we wanted to go we didn't want to just go fish, you know, your regular old lake or pond or stream or river. We wanted to, we like backpacking and hiking, so I went with two coworkers out to an area in Mount Hood National Forest on a fishing trip, I'll kind of condense the story, but we went on this fishing trip. One of my buddies, or my coworkers, was an experienced hiker, fisherman, and outdoorsman. The other gentleman that was with us was not. He actually was one of his first camping trips, and so he really didn't have much outdoor experience. And we get out to an area, a lake, and it was just beautiful. This area is beautiful. I mean, really beautiful. And it's fairly remote, you know. I mean, you do get some hikers that come through. There's a trail, but it's fairly remote. It's, you know, you just don't see a whole lot of people in this area. And especially if you go to some of the little bit higher elevation lakes, you'll see nobody. And that was our goal. Let's go out here fishing. Let's go to some of these other lakes and stuff. And so we did. We went out there, and what ended up happening was we got a little bit lost. We had set up camp. We went hiking to find this lake. We got a little bit lost. We ended up hiking like 16, 17 miles and finally made it back to our camp. Did a little fishing at the lake we were camping at, and, you know, cooked some dinner. We started a fire, cooked some dinner, and went to bed about 11. And we all had separate tents. So it was three tents next to this lake. And we woke up to what sounded like rocks being clanked together. At least two of us did. The third gentleman, Ian, the unexperienced outdoorsman, he was out cold. He was out cold. But my buddy Mitch and I... We heard what sounded like rock clanking. And so it was getting closer and closer, and we're just, you know, scratching our heads. You know, this is probably 1:32 in the morning, and we couldn't figure it out. We're kind of whispering back and forth, and we heard these knocks. And I've said this before. I wasn't out Bigfooting in this area. I wasn't out doing that. We didn't do it. Even then, I don't do it to this day really ever. I mean, occasionally. I wasn't out knocking stuff. Wasn't out yelling or screaming like, you know, you see on TV and stuff, and some of these other groups do. I will occasionally do that. But we were just out fishing. We were just kind of being a couple obnoxious guys, you know, having fun fishing, making noise, you know, and, you know, here we are, my buddy Mitch and I are laying in bed, and it did cross my mind. I said, you know, that this is weird. I have to admit, I'm trying to rationalize it, you know, because I heard this would sound like rock clanking, it's getting closer, and then these knocks, and then we started hearing what was sound like something walking around, sounded bipedal, you know, and so in my head, I'm thinking, could this be? I don't know. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking elk. It's definitely not a person. There's no freaking way. So I'm trying to rationalize it as my buddy Mitch and I are. Well, eventually this all dissipates and whatever it was took off. And the next morning we wake up and we give our buddy Ian a hard time because he didn't hear anything. He was out snoring. Mitch and I were kind of going over the night's events and kind of, you know, though exciting and weird, we kind of wrote it off. You know, we were there to fish, but the whole day it just kind of bugged me. And anyways, we go fishing, same sort of scenario. We hike into a couple of lakes, do some fishing. We come back that day from our hike, and same setup. You know, we do a little fishing at the lake we're camped at. We sit around a fire, we eat a meal, and we go to bed about 11 again. And this is supposed to be a three-night trip. This is the second night. We're in bed, and about the same time in the morning, that 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, we hear that rock clanking sound again, and Mitch and I are both awake, and he goes, hey, you know, it's back. I said, yeah, it's back, and we're listening, and this thing's getting closer and closer, and then you just start hearing, you know, like this movement up. We're kind of camped below a little bit of a hill, so something was going back and forth. It stopped the rock clanking and just started moving, if that's what was rock clanking. It started just moving back and forth on this hillside. You know, not too far away, and it's just breaking stuff. I couldn't tell if it was stepping on stuff, breaking it, or smacking a tree, but it was just, it sounded like an elephant going back and forth, and now I'm pretty amped up, I would say excitement, adrenaline, but fear. I'm starting to go, oh, man, what the heck? Buddy mentioned it's just quiet. We're quiet, and then that stops, and you hear this, whack. I mean, this, what I've learned or coined, I haven't coined this, but is known as a power knock. There was 5 of these knocks on a tree. This tree was hit so powerfully that you could feel it in your tent. You could just feel the vibration. It was just whack, 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 whack. Freak. Okay, yeah. My heart is in my head because I'm fairly confident and was well traversed in what animals and people are capable of. Whatever this was super powerful. I don't know if it was hitting a tree, you know, a log on a tree, if it was hitting its body on a tree or a rock. I had no idea, but it was so powerful you could feel in a tent. It woke my buddy Ian up, and he goes, what is that? What the heck? What's going on? And I said, shut up. I'm telling him to be quiet. And the knock stopped. All 3 of us are awake. We're sitting in our tents, and, I could barely – if there was a vocal, if anything was vocally said, I never heard it because my heart was in my head. Anyways, after these knocks stop, you hear something coming through the trees up high. When it was coming through the trees, I already knew what it was, and it was later confirmed. Something had thrown a rock, and you could hear it coming, hitting the branches, coming down from this hill down, and then thud, right next to my buddy Mitch's tent. And there was a little bit of, it was a little softer, a little bit muddy, and had that, you know, when a rock hits that kind of mud, that full, that kind of sound, that thud sound. And, you know, I was like, okay. And he's like, what? A rock, you know? And he's like, man, it's Bigfoot. You know, he was just like freaked out. I was freaked out. My buddy Ian on the side, he was really freaked out. We're all armed. I got a little worried that he wasn't experienced with a weapon. And I was a little worried he was going to come out shooting. He was freaking out. So I decided to unzip my tent and maybe come over there and say, hey, you know, knock it off or, you know, calm down. And I'm unzipping my tent. I'm just peering around. And out behind this tree, I see this shape at first. Just kind of, it looks like it's walking back and forth. It's going behind the tree, out from the tree, behind the tree, out from the tree. And then I see a shoulder and a hand on the front of this tree. And then I see the head. And this thing's just rocking back and forth. And it was massive. And I knew instantly, without knowing what I was looking at, and it just, I don't know if it heard me unzip the zipper, I don't know how long it was behind the tree, but, or if it caught eye of me peeking, it peeled off the tree and went up the trail and it was gone. And that was it. I mean, that was it. And basically, we all sat there awake, not saying a word. My buddies had no idea I'd seen anything. And a couple hours, and when daylight hit, we packed and left, and that was it. And it was supposed to be a 3-night trip. That's the gist of that encounter. And what it did for me was it solidified that Sasquatch is real.
Turns into an addict is what it does.
It does. It really does.
A Bigfoot addict is what it does.
Yeah. It gets you past the point of could they exist to the point of they do exist, and then you got a choice. Do you do something about it? You know, and what are they? You know, I mean, you know, it really solidified it for me. It freaked me out. At the same time, it launched me to where I'm at now. I've never had another sighting. I've had a lot of interesting occurrences. Real quick, so after that encounter, you know, I couldn't decide if I wanted to go back out there, if I wanted to go back out to the woods at all. But I started, it's an area that, as long as I lived in Oregon, I really hadn't researched or investigated. And so I said, well, you know, here I'm on a fishing trip. I'm not out doing any research or Bigfooting or anything, and I have an encounter, you know, and that has always stuck in my head as well. But so I started researching that area, and lo and behold, there's a lot of stuff that happened in that area. There's been a lot of sightings in the adjacent area. There were sightings at that particular lake we were at. There's a lot of history of Sasquatch reported stuff going on there. And, you know, as we've talked about, Todd, there's an interesting case of a missing guy out there, a guy by the name of Robert, that went missing under kind of mysterious circumstances. And so I'm not saying right off the bat that Bigfoot took this guy. There's a lot of natural things that could happen to someone in areas like this. But it was just an area where there's a lot of history, and this guy's an experienced backpacker fisherman, and he went missing. So I always, in the back of my head, I can't roll it in, I can't roll it out. You know, I do lean towards this guy probably fell under, you know, probably got lost, hurt himself, he was solo. It's like the worst thing you could do. Or had a heart attack, or God, who knows what. There's bears in this area and everything else, so who knows what. But the fact that there's been a lot of sightings in this area, and it depends how you look at it, I guess, too. I won't say they're aggressive sightings, but, you know, I mean, in my boat, when I had my encounter, how do I take that? Is that aggressive? Are they just trying to shoo you off? I mean, aggressive, I guess, you know, they could have came in and flattened all the tents. They didn't. You know. But aggressive, I guess, is to each his own. I took it as a little bit aggressive, like, hey, you know, get out of here. I mean, you come ports or encounters where something's come back twice to the same location. You know, that sounds more than curiosity. It sounds like, hey, get out. But I could be wrong. I don't know. That's just a guess.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it depends on what you listen to. I mean, there's so many different theories on Bigfoot, but I know you read any of David Pilates' books and you don't ever want to go in the woods again. And I looked up the Bizzle's story when he disappeared there. Yeah, like you said, it could be anything, but, you know, it does seem kind of fit the profile of, you know, missing persons throughout parks and across the U.S. and the world. And some of it, I'm thinking, has to be Bigfoot. I've got a friend in Texas whose buddy, we're at the house, and the one was watching him go up and down on one of those trampolines. So there's a fascination with kids there, and obviously if they're highly intelligent primates or – you know, whatever, highly intelligent, they get bored. You know, it's not more, you know, it's more than just, they're pretty much the apex predator of the woods, and you got all kinds of time on your hands. Let's watch a few humans throw some bobbers into the water, or, you know, look at this kid. And so I don't doubt for a second that there's aggressive ones. I don't think it's wholesale when I see Pilates stuff, you know, wholesale Bigfoot taking them. And he doesn't say that, but you certainly think that at first, and then you start listening, and it sounds like something else. But, you know, I know you had an encounter in that area, so I kind of wanted to ask about that. But that's pretty interesting. It's cool, and makes you want to go armed. And I know, I'll tell you what, best prayer time I ever had was going Bigfooting, because at night when you're terrified and you're thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to die. What am I doing out here? But that's part of the fun. It's that roller coaster experience, going out in that woods and – it's a different world at night, and it's part of the whole fun of the whole mystique and thing of the Bigfoot stuff. But so that's a pretty cool experience for you. But so have you had anything like that when you've been anything similar, anything crazy with the OBF when you were with the OBP? the Olympic project. Yeah, when you've gone with them.
Yeah, you know, a few odd things. Definitely had some, definitely recorded and heard in person some very powerful knocks. I've never experienced quite the knocks I experienced back in 2011. Those knocks were, I mean, this thing was close. And so I've never experienced those kind of knocks. But the OP, I've got some, I've had some interesting stuff happen up there. We had Adam Davis up with us one time for a trip, an expedition. And we had something pacing us over the hill, back and forth, back and forth. We had a fairly large group of people, and they were all hearing this thing move back and forth, and rocks were coming down the hill, probably not toss. I think whatever was moving up on this hill the was, you know, kicking up rocks. But we were hearing grunts, and it didn't sound like a bear grunt in this area. It really didn't make sense for a bear to be going back and forth the way it was, even though, and we pretty much ruled out bear. what Adam did was haven't been around in the Congo, and so I haven't been around apes. He took on this position of like the dominant male. He left the party, our group, walked into this clearing and peed. And it seemed to really, you know, kind of like, hey, I'm marking my territory. He had his harem, and it really seemed to tick this thing off, you know, and no one laid eyes on it. It was at night. And whatever it was, it kind of seemed like it ticked this thing off, and it was moving up on this hill. We're all hearing it, and eventually it quieted down, and whatever it was took off. What I had done was I placed some audio out there. We got back at 2 or 3 in the morning. So the next day we went out there, and I placed some audio, and on that audio I got that following night, I got the most primate-sounding grunts, growls. It's my favorite recording to this date. It's so primate-like, gorilla-like or chimpanzee, I don't know, but it's very primate-like. And the whole, if you look at the whole picture, especially – you know, not just listening to the audio, but looking at the audio on Sonic Visualizer and looking at the patterns, that was pretty compelling. I've had areas up there where I've been camping and recorded what sounds like chest slaps that match.
Oh, that's
if you
cool.
look it up. It is cool. And they match other possible chest slaps recorded from around the country. And they also happen to match what sound – if you're looking at this visually on Sonic Visualizer, you put this audio up on your computer and you have like programs in the software like Sonic Visualizer or Audacity. You put it up there and you put in a gorilla chest slap, a known gorilla chest slap, and you put in this suspect or unknown chest slap or sounds like a chest slap. They match almost – I mean, it's uncanny how closely the variance is. I mean, it's so similar. And so that was interesting. I've had a lot of interesting things happen at the OP, investigate a lot of reports. Some of the more interesting stuff I've had happen, because now I'm kind of stuck with Mount Hood area because of my encounter. I've had one of the things we used to do, now I've never had another sighting out there, and I've never heard any vocals. I've never heard, like, a yell or scream out there ever, which I've always found weird because in other areas I have, like the OP, we've recorded and heard some awesome yells and screams. But we'd camp. One of the things we do is we camp at this particular lake where this Mr. Bissell went missing. And there was a time there where my buddy Mitch and I were back out there. We were putting trail cameras up, and we, you know, as we're always out in these areas, we'll fish. And so I'm fishing, and he starts hearing a grunt, and he's on one side of the lake. It's not a very big lake. These are mountain lakes. He's on one side of the lake. I'm on the other side of the lake. We have walkies, and he's hearing something grunt. And I said, well, you know, what's it sound like? He said, well, it's kind of piggish, you know. And I said, well, you know, there is a large bear in this area. We've seen him. You know, he's up there for the berries and whatnot. He doesn't mess with us, and he's a big bear. And I said, it's probably the bear, so if you're not uncomfortable, come back around. So he was a little bit uncomfortable, so he made the little trek around the lake back to me. And as we're talking, as he meets me, and we're talking, looking over that side of the lake, up on this rock slide area is this bush. There's multiple big bushes, and it's shaking back and forth violently. And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a nice sunny day. There's no wind. So something's shaking that tree. And I'm thinking, man, that bear moved fast to get up to where that bush is, or there's two of something. And so we're watching this thing shake, and then all of a sudden there's a knock off to our left, and then there's a knock to our right, and then we start hearing whistles. And these whistles are kind of human-like, but coarse, short. I mean, just they were weird. And we really – yeah, there are birds in the area, but we really didn't hear too many birds or anything. And as we're kind of like looking at each other, we hear this crack, crack, crack. And that was, you know, what we heard was the sound of a tree coming down. There was a tree that had come down. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no wind. Yes, trees do fall. We just thought with all this stuff going on, it was a weird thing. And the weird thing was we had our tent set up, and where this tree came down, we knew that this tree had to be fairly fell over close to wherever our tent was. And so we end up kind of slowly making our way down the trail. It's a well-used game trail, well-used trail. So we go back down this trail towards our tent and come across this tree right across the trail. It was a dead tree. It was a large tree. It looked like something had walked on top of it and crushed it. And behind the stump where this thing had been pushed over was a real flat area. Something looked like something had been behind this tree. This was 40 feet or so from our tent. And my buddy Mitch is like, I'm done. I'm out. I'm done. And, you know, we didn't see anything, but just with whatever was going on, of course, we were camping in an area where this guy had went missing, so I know that was in his head. I have taken 2 reports from this particular lake in the last couple of years where people have either seen a Sasquatch or heard what sounded like an elephant coming down the trail and stopping and then knocks. So that was one of the more interesting things that we had happen. I've also done a lot of work on the Tillamook. Yeah, go ahead, Todd.
No, that you just it's funny as you're talking. This is what's cool about having a show or talking to somebody. You're jarred. 2 weeks ago, I had a friend that has kind of evolved into a Bigfoot believer from mocking me over the years, and not really bad, but ribbing me. And him and his wife were on 4-wheelers, and they hear this grunt in the woods. And I'm guessing that, well, they're on a 4-wheeler, and that the grunt had to be pretty loud for him to hear the 4-wheeler. But, you know, he was telling people when you could tell, I need to get back with him. Just he was really unnerved by it. It was during the day, and it was in an area I know there's Bigfoot actually been photographed within a few miles of there. So it's funny you say something like that. It jogs a memory. You said something about, peeing to mark an area. I know a person that swears that when her husband was gone at one point, the thing took one of the males took a leak all over her porch. They were there all the time. She'd feed them grapes, and it literally took a leak on the porch one time. So, you forget about all that stuff, and you're thinking, you know, when you hear stuff like this, that's why it's good for us. I'm kind of an old man now, 50. You're probably still a youngster in your 30s, but, you know, it helps jogging in, and it gets that brain and blood going. It's cool to hear stuff like that. But before you go on, and I want to ask you real fast, have you ever heard anything like metallic sounds? I mean, I have just hit a guardrail and got a mile or so in a metallic sound. And then 10 minutes later, that metallic sound is almost on us as we're getting into the car. And I'm just curious, like in an area like that and you're in deep woods, it's freaky when you're even near the woods getting a metallic sound because no one's carrying a guardrail or a baseball bat at 11-something at night, and it's hard to believe, you know, Sasquatch is either. But have you ever heard anything crazy like that when you've been out? Or
Yes, there's been a couple occurrences. One was we did figure out that something probably had thrown a rock in our camp and hit we had it all on audio, so everything was recorded, including a grunt, another primate. That was actually a rock hitting metal. But I know David Ellis, he's our audio guy for the Limit Project, and he's got a ton of recordings, kind of like what you're describing in odd, weird areas. You know, I was out in the Tillamook Forest and heard something very much like that, something that sounded like metallic, where there shouldn't be nothing metallic out there. An occurrence that happened to Gunnar Monson and a buddy of ours, another researcher, Larry Turner, they had something, I won't say it was metallic, but like you said, jogging the memory, because I got loads of, you know, anecdotal stories and stuff, but they were going down this trail, and off to the right, they heard what sounded like bass, like a real loud radio bass playing, you know, in the car, but there was no cars in this area. There couldn't be a car in this area. they were trying to figure it out, and it started getting closer and closer to the point where, you know, Larry Turner is a good friend of mine. He's a hunter. He's been in the woods. He knows this area well. He started getting a little freaked out, and whatever it was getting closer and closer, and then it sounded like it was following them as they're backing out of there. He has this recorded too, and it's weird. I got nothing. If it's not a car, bass, I don't know what it is, because it's very loud. It's reverberating, and it was constant. It would stop, it would go, and it did have some metallic qualities to it. But kind of what you're describing, maybe one time in the Tillamook Forest area, I heard something would sound like metallic when there shouldn't have been nothing metallic out there. I've got no idea where it came from. I didn't really have anything, much context to go around whatever could have transpired there, but but David Ellis has got a ton of recordings like that, because that's a phenomenon actually recorded around the country, and he's you should contact him on it, because he's got some really cool stories on those metallic stuff, and it's something he actually looks for now in reports.
That's awesome. I just sent him literally two Sundays ago. I had the best sound, second best sound I've ever had. Darn crickets. I mean, and I contacted Cliff because I couldn't figure out how to get around the cliff. A friend that was with me was freaking out, and it was awesome. It was like a minute and a half call back, and it was just going off, and you're thinking, I got a good recording, and then you get home, and it's crickets. And you can hear some of it. I sent it to Dave last week. He hasn't got back with me. But anyone out there, Dave Ellis and Olympic Project, you want to see something visually analyzed, send him an email, and he'll visually analyze, send it back to you. But it gives you a real good comparison. That was one of the cool things going up to the Olympic Project, is seeing a visual of your recordings and stuff. And I thought that was cool. But anyhow, I didn't mean to get all the way sidetracked. That's just my brain is going 85 directions. And get back. What were you talking about? Do you remember what you were talking about before I cut you off with the metallic?
Not offhand. I was going to say, you know, I've had a lot of odd experiences, or you know, and maybe possible Sasquatch. I possibly had some Sasquatch stuff, but nothing for sure. But like I said, I've spent so much time in the freaking woods, it's unbelievable. And you know, you forget stuff, you know, that happened. You know, I have it all documented and cataloged and all that, but you forget stuff. And then when you get to talk, and you kind of jar the memory there, and you're like, oh, yeah, you were just talking about the urinating thing. And that brought me back to the lake I was just telling you about, where we had the tree possibly pushed over and the other stuff, and that I've taken a couple reports from. Well, I took a BO4 investigator and a Lund Project member by the name of Cindy Cadell out there, with a buddy of mine, Duncan Jensen, and Cindy's daughter out there. We were out in this area, and two or so in the morning, I kind of hear someone walking around our camp, and it seemed to kind of stop on the other side of Cindy's tent somewhere, and then I kind of lost it, and I was just getting ready to pop out when I saw the shadow looming over my tent. It wasn't right over my tent, but it looked like something was swaying back and forth. I was thinking, you know, there's a tree behind me, and it was a little bit windy. I was thinking it's this tree swaying back and forth. And then I saw what looked like a branch drop, you know, which I took to maybe be an arm. It was out. And so I'm whispering over to Cindy, and Cindy's whispering over to me, and we had never heard each other. We were both awake. And so I get out of my tent, I'm looking around, I don't see anything. Where it was gone. The next morning I wake up, and I was telling, hey, Cindy, you know, I heard something last week. She's like, I did too. I was yelling, I was whispering for you. And I'm like, well, I was whispering for you. Anyways, we never heard each other, but she had heard something come up behind her tent, and several yards away, she asked me, is there any water behind my tent? And I said, no, there's no water. The lake's up there, and there's another lake down here. There's no water, there's no creeks, no nothing. She goes, it sounded like an elephant taking a leak. And I said, really? And so something had sounded like something walked up kind of up behind her tent and took a leak. And I went back there. I didn't see anything.
That's hilarious.
But it's sole owl and bushes. And, yeah, and I thought that was interesting because I had seen something, I think, maybe possibly outside the tent. So, anyways, that's just another story. And, you know, here real quick, I don't want to take up the whole show here, but, you know, I have – in my possession now, I have thermal equipment. I wish I had thermal equipment on some of these past, you know, these experiences that happened years ago. Maybe I would I'd come away with a lot more than I think I saw something or I recorded something, because I got a lot of great audio, I think, but it's ambiguous. You know, audio, unfortunately, is ambiguous.
Yes.
You know, and thermal. If you use a therm and actually record something on therm or camera or whatever, it's a lot more compelling. It probably won't get you proof, but for a researcher or investigator, it adds a lot to your table. And so, you know, fortunately now we have with the LIM project, we have gotten some very interesting, you know, thermal footage, sometimes from a distance, sometimes close. And so, you know, it's one of those things, it's trial and error. And then, you know, things cost money. You know this, things cost money.
Yeah.
Thermal equipment, audio recorders, batteries, everything costs money. And none of us get paid to do this. I think some deserve it. Not me per se, but there's a lot of really good investigators out there. I wish they could put some money in their pocket and maybe get a little bit further along with this stuff. But yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there.
That's awesome. Yeah. Any kind of, you know, technology. I know, my friend Chester Moore, they had Animal X from Australia back in 2008 in a big thicket. And they had a lot of activity that wasn't shown on that show, a lot of branches that there's no way humans could break. I mean, just tore up the next morning where the film crew was at. But they had thermal footage that possibly it was something big. I mean, it wasn't a deer or anything, so it's a good chance that it was a Bigfoot. But anything like that helps. And, you know, you're not going to, other than a carcass DNA, you're not going to convince the skeptics. But you know what? If people can't figure out there's something out there in the woods and everyone's lying and seeing things, then that's something that they have to deal with themselves, because they just don't want to, you know, it's just not possible that all these people have had all this activity and seen all these things without there being some truth to the phenomenon. But you guys are working on some interesting stuff with the Olympic Project. You mind talking about that? Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, Derek Randles and myself just got done speaking at the International Bigfoot Conference in Kennewick, Washington, where we shared kind of this ongoing research project. And basically, Todd, you're aware of this, but basically we were a timber company came across something very interesting, and basically what they had discovered, or this particular flagger, the surveyor had discovered, was a nest. And this nest is in a very remote and rugged area where you would have to have a purpose to be out there. And of course he had a purpose. He was flagging an area that was going to be logged. Came across a nest, and he came across another nest, and it kind of spooked him out, freaked him out. And his, you know, I think his 25, 26 years of experience in the Pacific Northwest doing what he does, he'd never come across anything like this. And he's ran into bears and you name it, in every sort of ground bed you could imagine. And he had never seen anything like this. And so he contacted his superiors and Derek Randles, who is a landscaper by trade. Of course, you know, the leader of the Olympic Project, but a landscaper by trade, had done work for this particular guy years ago. And so he said, hey, contacted Derek, said, hey, you know, we came across these weird, we know you're kind of into the Bigfoot thing. We're not saying it's that. We're just saying it's weird. We'll see if you've ever seen anything like this before. And they bring Derek out there, and along with Derek, our other partner, James Millian, go out there. And quite a good-sized group of them go out there, and they actually discovered a few more nests. And they started hearing some stuff move around, and some of these guys got a little bit freaked out, and so all left. But they gave basically the Olympic Project permission to study this area for a number of years. They decided not to log it. They knew they were looking at something very interesting, and they had no clue what it was. And so subsequently, bring me aboard on this, and I've been out to this area probably the most now, other than maybe Derek Randles. We've discovered 21 ground nests. These nests are anywhere from about 3 feet to upwards of, you know, 9 feet. They're big, and some are round, some are oval. These 21 nests are spread out over about 6 to 7 fingers, and by fingers, I mean you got this ridge, this western-facing ridge, and these fingers, these ridges, or fingers that come off this ridge, they're small, but they have nests, and whatever is making these nests has built them not just one finger, but multiple fingers. On the largest nest to date, sits all by itself, and it's on one of the furthest easterly positioned fingers. They're all western facing. They got nice. They get sun and all that. These nests are very difficult to get to. They're made solely out of huckleberry tips, and the huckleberry in this area grows from, you know, a couple of feet to upwards of 9 feet. And a lot of people go, "Oh, huckleberry doesn't get that tall." Well, yeah, it does. If it gets sun, it gets that tall. And in this area, it's that tall and that thick. And there's huckleberry tips snapped off at 8, 9 feet off the ground. A very thick huckleberry. It's not a. I can't. Some of these branches are 2.5, 3 inches in diameter. I can't snap that. None of the guys I work with can snap that stuff. Someone's just twisted. But these nests are massive, and something massive has been laying in the center of them. We've been studying these nests. We've pulled a lot of hair out of this nest that we have had visually analyzed that comes back unknown, and possibly primate-like. It has no medulla in the center of it. You know, bear hair has medulla. And so this hair matches also some other unknown hair from different portions of the country. We sent this hair off to Cindy Dosen out of Vancouver Island, and she's got her gold standard as a suspect or unknown hair that she contributes to possibly being a Sasquatch hair. And there's multiple samples, and this kind of matched up with that. And whatever made these nests, the hair is consistent from the top of the nest to the bottom of these nests. And they are very much like nests. And they're constructed, like I said, either oval or circular. They're massive. It looks like something intelligent has put these together. We had Dr. Jeff Meldrum come out to take soil samples, hair samples, and nest samples. And one of the things that Dr. Jeff Meldrum, out of Idaho State University, you know, he's an anthropologist, one of the things that he found interesting was there were sticks pushed into the ground in the corners and around the edges, pushed into the ground. And then this nest was kind of almost like made around, or the huckleberry was put around these sticks. Now, that wow. to me shows intelligence, and that is very interesting and compelling to me. And the reason we brought Dr. Jeff Meldrum into this is we've been at this for 2 years. We've had a couple trail cameras in these areas. It doesn't look like anything's been back in this area for at least 2.5 years, not in the general nest area. There's been some other stuff that's happened in the general vicinity. But nothing looks like it's come through the nest and reused these nests. And the reason we brought Jeff Meldrum in was because we kind of, you know, we're citizen scientists, we're you know, trackers and all that, but we're not scientists. Dr. Jeff Meldrum is. And he has a partner, an associate by the name of Dr. Todd Disatel, who works with DNA. And so we brought Meldrum in to take to properly collect soil samples, nest samples, and hair samples that are going to be tested via environmental DNA, eDNA. It's kind of a new thing where they can test the soil and tell you everything that's been laying in that nest or in that area. And they're going to tell you, okay, and they're going to get the usual suspects, no doubt. They'll get, you know, probably bear and deer and everything else, raccoon. But what we're looking for is something more unknown, maybe something more primate-like, more human-like. And so it's very exciting because this, to me, is the future of Sasquatch research or Bigfoot research. This environmental DNA has been used in cave systems around the world to identify what's been in a cave. And it doesn't just look at, you know, it can tell you what's been there, you know, for eons. I mean, for a long period of time.
That's cool.
You know, and it's exciting because it's just, you know, it's an expensive process. You know, that's the one thing about research is it's never cheap, and especially this level of investigation and research, this is a whole new level. You know, these samples are like, to test the soil, it's like $1,000 a pop, roughly, about $1,000 a pop.
Wow.
So you got seven samples, you know, you're looking at $700,000, and there's no guarantees. So it's really, it's exciting. It's been a labor of love. It's, you know, but I will say real quick, this area these nests are in, they sit on these fingers. There's a large salmon creek down below that seasonally gets, you could walk across the salmon. They're coming up to spawn. I mean, you can walk across them. I've seen the carcasses. It's got the huckleberry is just prevalent. There's huckleberry everywhere, seasonally in this time, you know, berries this time of year, or certain times of year. And then there's tons of ungulates. You got deer and a lot of other critters out there to munch on. And it's hard to get to. It's enclosed. Nobody's sneaking into this area. This area hasn't been logged in 50 years. These nests are, 2.5-3 miles back behind lock gates. It's what I call the perfect storm when it comes to if this is Sasquatch related. This would be a great spot to build a nest. And you know, for whatever reason, those nests may be built.
Well, I've checked around here and friends in Texas and Louisiana, and have asked about the nest. Most of the stuff has not been anything near as elaborate. It's interesting that they have there. It's hard to believe it's only one spot that there are nests up there, and would make me wonder, okay, let me look for similar areas when I know there's Bigfoot activity, and maybe there's nests buried deep in the woods in these places too. Because it sounds like, I mean, you don't build a nest to just be there for a few days. You're there
right.
for a long period of time. And seasonal salmon, well, you got seasonal salmon all up the western seaboard, so... You know, gets your brain going, and you know the way you can map stuff with, you know, they're mapping fires and everything else, and you're mapping patterns with the squatchometrics. You know, you should be able to find some spots that got some real potential for some exciting stuff. But that's really cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the goal is to come up. Anything past that they have as far as that goal, or I mean, is it just the goal is to come up with DNA and then just leave it at that, or just see where that develops?
Well, no. I mean, if something significant comes from this, each scientist has their expertise. It'll be passed on. If there's some sort of interesting or unknown DNA that comes out of this, you know, then they'll have the hair to look at as well. Now, the hair, you're not really going to pull DNA from. There's no follicles. I haven't seen any follicles, and that's really where you get the DNA from, is on the follicles of the hair. The hair you could visually look at, and you could rule out a lot of stuff. It's the ruling in that gets to be the difficult part. You can rule out a lot of stuff, and we already have. So you got that, and you got the nests themselves. You got the construction of them.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you got the whole devastation in the area. So I think with the DNA in, and you have this whole picture come together, you know, no matter what, at the end of the day, what we have is unknown hair, unknown nest, and unknown behavior. We're not screaming at Sasquatch. You know, I got my ideas, my hypotheses, and my own personal opinions. But the cool thing is, this could be some unknown sort of behavior of some other animal, but I don't think so. It just doesn't match. It looks like something with an opposable thumb would need to have made these nests.
Just... Well, the pinning down alone, I mean, it just, you know, it just, it would be pretty shocking to see something like that. It makes you wonder, I mean, you look at the woods totally differently when you see something like that. But lastly, we're about running out of time here you probably go on for hours talking about stuff. What kind of projects other than the Olympic project are you working on? Do you have anything plans in the future any kind of goals that you're hoping to get, you know, again, past this DNA and stuff?
Yeah, I know you're closing in on time here, and I could talk for hours, but really with these nests, we're trying to replicate this nest line. We're trying to look at other areas where there could be a similar perfect storm or similar area where we could find more nests, because whatever made these nests has made nests somewhere else, and it's just a matter of looking at why this area that these nests are in and then replicating that somewhere else. And we got about 3 or 4 areas. It's going to take us 2 or 3 years to look into that we're hoping, and we have high hopes that may have other nests similar to this. But it really, you know, we are waiting to see what comes from these soil samples, this DNA test, these environmental DNA. Really curious about that. And of course, I'm doing a lot of research on the Tillamook Coast in Oregon and Washington. And so my goal is just to keep collecting data to form possible patterns and predictability. That's where my head's at. It's really about the data. I know these things do exist. Now it's a matter of what are they and what are they doing and where are they going and all that. So it's a different approach. You know, I don't need to be chasing stories anymore, but I do love chasing data, and that's what I'm about, and that's kind of what the future holds.
Yeah, I think as I get older, I'm more into data than I am to chasing too. So that's cool. Well, Shane, thanks for coming on. I mean, I could have you on longer, and another time maybe you'd like to come on, and I'm better at this. But thanks for calling, everyone. Shane Corson of the Olympic Project's Monster X Radio. turn into it. He's a great guy and a great researcher. Thanks, Shane. I appreciate it big time.
Thank you, Todd.